Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to The Dr. Nina Show with Dr. Nina Savelle Rocklin, only on LA Talk Radio.
Hey there, welcome to The Dr. Nina Show here on LA Talk Radio. I am your host, Dr. Nina Savelle Rocklin, and I am here to help you stop counting calories, carbs, and fat grams so you can easily get to a healthy weight and get on with your life. Because that's what it's all about, right? I want you to wake up and think about your day, not your diet. If you'd like to join me today, the number here in the studio is 818-602-4929. That's 818-602-4929. I would love to hear what's on your mind, what is weighing on you, because the real problem is not what you're eating. It is what's eating at you. So this week is National Eating Disorders Awareness Week. And here's something you may not know about eating disorders. Now, lots of people, when they hear eating disorders, they picture anorexic teenage girls. Anorexic white teenage girls, actually. And that is absolutely not the case. Eating disorders impact everyone, regardless of age, ethnicity, or gender. And here's something else you may not know. The most common eating disorder is... had to use my drums. The most common eating disorder is binge eating disorder. Now, here's what the husband of one of my patients several years ago, what he told her was, he said, binge eating isn't a real disorder. It's just an excuse for eating too much. Nice, huh? Well, they're not married anymore. Big surprise. Oops, got a call already. Oh, caller, I did not see the screen. So if you, there you are. I think I know who it is. Nicole.
Dr. Nina.
Hi, Nicole.
How are you?
I'm fine. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. I'm calling today because I want to ask you about two things. So the first one is I want to ask you about just like taking vitamins and probiotics. I know, like, I try to get most of my vitamins from food, like eating healthy, nutritious foods like vegetables and fruits. But I don't know if it's like necessary or acceptable to take something in addition, and if there's any harm. And then my second question is about like being all or nothing. I find that I'm like all or nothing, maybe that goes back to being deprived, but I'm not deprived though. Anyways, just being all or nothing. I'm just very all or nothing.
Okay. So first of all, since I can't give medical advice, but I can tell you what my doctor told me about supplements and vitamins. And he said that the new thinking in this is not to take supplements and not to take vitamins. And he only recommends that people take supplements if they have a deficiency.
Really?
Yes. And that the recommendation is really that you should get your vitamins from food and not from supplements. I mean, I know you said that you were also getting them from food, but he said that that is the most current thought right now. So that comes straight from my doctor. And that's so that's the best that I can do with respect to that question. Now,
how about a probiotic?
You know, the problem with probiotics is, and this comes from a friend of mine who's a gastroenterologist. She says that a lot of times people take probiotics and it makes things worse because their stomach issues or whatever are not helped by those particular probiotics, and that they actually sometimes that it can make it worse. So you really need to, before you take any supplement, figure out why you're taking it and talk to your doctor about it.
Okay. Okay, that helps. Thank you.
You're welcome.
So now to
my area of expertise, which is psychology. Yeah. So black and white thinking is also called like dichotomous thinking, whatever. The reason that people do black and white thinking is that when things are black or white, all or nothing, either or, it gives you a sense of sort of safety, like, hey, there's no messy in between. We can't use shades of gray anymore, but because that has a whole other connotation. But we can say, you know, rainbow. There's a rainbow between black and white, but that could be messy. So black and white thinking creates some kind of certainty.
Yeah,
and so. You know what? So if you are doing something you don't want to do, like thinking all or nothing, or eating something you don't want to do, there's always a reason. And when you can excavate the reason and look at it, then you can deal with it. So how does the need for certainty show up in your life right now? I know a couple of weeks ago or last week, I can't remember now.
Yeah,
when you said you had left your job. So how? How does that affect you as far as uncertainty?
Yeah, I guess kind of uncertainty about what I'm going to do, uncertainty about what I want to do, uncertainty about how things are going to just pan out in life.
That's a lot.
I guess there's a lot of uncertainty.
Yes,
yeah.
That's a lot of uncertainty, a lot of unknowns, and there's only so much that you can do to create that what's next, you know, sense that will lead you to certainty or however much certainty we can have in our lives. So it makes sense then that because so much is up in the air and you're in this in-between stage, hopefully we'll be short, but this in-between stage, it makes sense that you would be very drawn to all or nothing thinking and then maybe impose that on food and other areas. Because it
makes you feel safe. Because at least I can be certain. I can control and be certain about one thing. So I'm okay. I see that. Is it a control thing too?
I think it's a sense of having mastery over your life. I mean, you can use the word control, but control is kind of a negative connotation, and it's. I'm not sure it completely fits the situation. It's more like giving yourself a sense of. Safety and mastery over aspects of your life because other aspects of your life feel so cloudy.
Okay, that makes such sense. That makes such good sense that I can totally relate. That makes sense.
Yeah, and
okay,
then... So then instead of focusing on all or nothing when it comes to food, think about what you can actually do in your life, what steps can you take to create the next phase of your life, whatever that is, and also get more comfortable with uncertainty.
Get more comfortable with uncertainty. Okay. I can work on that.
Yeah.
Okay. And figure out the next step. Okay.
Yeah. And
I like that. That's all stuff I can do.
And how you get more comfortable with uncertainty is you remind yourself that whatever this in-between stage is, it's not going to last forever. And there are aspects that you're behind the wheel of your life, the car of your life. You're in the driver's seat. So you're not going to just let life is not going to just happen to you. You can do things to make it happen for you.
Right. Okay, I like all of that. Okay, working on that. We'll work on that. It's in the works. Thank you. But it's funny. I really, like, I wake up in the morning, and if I start my day right, like, if in my head I have I know nothing's good or bad, but if I have, like, a good breath, I'm still using these words. I don't know what other words to use. But if I have, like, you know, just, like, an egg and a string cheese, like in my head, that's good and healthy and low calorie and high protein, low carb. Okay, so I did good, quote unquote. I don't know what other word to use.
How about I satisfying? Like, oh, I had a breakfast that was really satisfying to me. Because when you start using words like good or bad, that becomes good you or bad you. So if you have something you consider bad, then you're going to feel like the day is getting off to a bad start. You're going to feel bad about yourself. And then the whole day has a cloud of gloom over it. And that's why I started saying, like, hey, I want you to think about your day, not your diet.
Right. Yeah, I'm obsessing over my – I obsess over my diet. Like, the other day I did – I took a yoga class, and then I took a Pilates class, and then I did an hour on the treadmill. So I worked out for 3 hours, which is a lot. Like,
that's
a lot. I was in pain yesterday. I'm not going to lie.
you don't have to lie. That's a lot. I talk to you just about every week, and I could tell that you're a bright, kind person, hardworking person.
Thank you.
I would so much rather you call me and say, you know what? I woke up today and I thought, I'm smart. I'm capable. I've got all kinds of qualities that make me feel good about myself. I'm going to focus on those instead of, well, I ate this particular breakfast food and now I feel all good about myself.
Okay. that sounds more substantial, more real. Yeah.
And I think better for
I sound like an idiot.
What?
I sound like now that I'm thinking about it, like when I say, like if I'm like, oh, I ate low calorie breakfast, like I'm a good person, like it sounds like an idiot. Like the advice you're giving is so solid. Like, think about you're a good person, you're smart, you're capable. Not I had a low calorie breakfast, low carb, so I'm good, you know? Like,
yes,
I resonate.
I'm glad. I would rather you not feel like an idiot. I'd rather you say, wow, that really gives me perspective, and I'm going to make that shift, that mindset shift. Because really, what you eat for breakfast does not define your good enoughness.
Yeah. Maybe a part of it is that I also don't feel like I'm good enough, you know, in general. And maybe that's translating into other parts of my life. Including food.
Yes. So then that is what's eating at you. Why do you not feel like you're good enough? What is it that is good enough? I hear this a lot of times. People are like, I just don't feel like I'm good enough. I'm not good enough. And I say, well, what is good enough? What is the standard that you're using for good enough? And they're like, I don't know. I just know I'm not good enough.
Yeah. Right.
So two things have to happen. One is you have to figure out what your definition of good enough is.
Right.
And how do you know you're not already there? And secondly, you need to address where you learned this notion of not being good enough and challenge that, which I'm happy to help you with. So.
Okay. I think the standard of what's good enough is just comparing. Like, I know everyone's I don't want to say everyone's like a package, but like, you know, like everyone has like their strengths and weaknesses. And I want to be strong in every aspect. So it comes to like comparing myself to other people, which is like the worst thing I could do. Cause it's like, you should compare yourself to yourself, not to anybody else. So I guess that's where the standard or good enough is coming from.
Well, you know, why don't you give it some thought and call me next week and let's talk specifically about this. But I want to leave you with two thoughts. One is don't compare your real life with someone else's highlight reel.
Right.
Which is social media. I mean, I can't tell you how many times I've been someplace, and once I was at a party and my friends were kind of like having a little spat, like the husband and wife were having a little tiff, and then all of a sudden it was like, oh, we need to take a picture, and so they went from to you know, like posing for Instagram, and you'd look at this picture and you'd never know that they were just at each other. So don't compare what you see, which is what people present, which is a mask often, with you know, your real life. That's a highlight reel that they're giving you. And secondly,
that's good advice.
Yeah, and secondly, what are the criteria that you're think about? What are the criteria that you have for a good enough life and a good enough you? So
okay, I'm gonna write that down. Criteria
for a good good enough life and a good enough
and
you.
Good enough. Okay.
Okay.
Thank you, Dr. Nina.
You're welcome. Call me next week and we'll talk more.
Okay.
All right.
I have to be the whole week. Okay. Thanks.
Okay.
Okay. Bye.
Bye, Nicole.
Bye.
Well, I'm sure a lot of you can relate to that black and white thinking and the good enoughness and all of that, including, as I was saying, my patient whose husband told her that binge eating was an excuse for eating too much. She never felt good enough for him. And guess what? They're not married anymore. Big surprise. Ha! Huh. Talk about supportive. Not. Okay, so to address this idea of binge eating disorder, which a lot of people don't know that they have. They just think, I've got a problem with food. I have no willpower. I'm a food addict. And actually, no, they have binge eating disorder. They don't know it. Binge eating disorder is treatable. So this idea of, hey, this is just an excuse. It's not a real diagnosis. It's just an excuse. To address this, I turn to Sunny C. Gold. She is her name is Sunny C. Gold. She is a journalist, a body acceptance advocate, and the author of the book, Food, The Good Girl's Drug, How to Stop Using Food to Control Your Feelings. Guys, you could probably read it too. Okay, so she says, look, what pops into your head when she says binge eating disorder? She says, a white woman in a large body wearing a stained gray sweatshirt shoving food in her mouth. A pudgy hand reaching for a giant plate of donuts. That's exactly what people picture, how most people picture people with binge eating disorder. It's also exactly what comes up when you do a Google image search on binge eating disorder. This particular thing drives me crazy. Every book on Amazon has like someone standing in the refrigerator scarfing down a bunch of food. It's so, awful. It may be your, you know, sometimes your experience, but that is a stereotype, and all it does is shame someone. Okay, I digress. So these are unhelpful stereotypes. And it is a stereotype that often many doctors and eating disorder professionals believe. And that makes it harder for people to get diagnosed and to get the help that they need. She says, as a journalist with a history of binge eating disorder, it's a mission of mine to bust myths about the disorder. So here are her myths. Myth number one, people with binge eating disorder are fat. Someone's calling me. People with binge eating disorder are fat. It seems like common sense that someone who regularly eats large amounts of food when not feeling physically hungry would live in a bigger body. More calories equals higher weight, right? Now, about 60% of people who have binge eating disorder are overweight or even obese. Another word I hate. 40% of people with binge eating disorder are normal weight or even underweight. Janet Jackson has been candid in some interviews about her binge eating. Kathy Griffin, the comedian Kathy Griffin, who's small, tiny, thin, she's written about having binge eating disorder. Tennis champion Monica Seles told her story during National Binge Eating Disorder Awareness Campaign a couple years ago. A friend of Sunny's, who was a thin person who's now an eating disorder activist, recalled that a doctor once told her when she revealed that she was binge eating and she might have a binge eating disorder, the doctor said, well, just don't eat the second piece of cake. Really? Okay. Because she wasn't overweight or obese, he didn't take her concern seriously, and he wasn't worried about her health. So myth number two, here we go. Binge eating isn't a real condition. Binge eating disorder is listed as an official disorder in the DSM-5. That is the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders by the American Psychiatric Association, which is basically the Bible for a diagnosed psychiatric mental health, emotional disorders kind of manual. And yet there are still a lot of people who think it's not real. People say, oh, it's a disorder made up by drug companies, which is awfully silly because a drug can't actually change your binge eating. It's a psychological thing, not a brain thing. Binge eating disorder is just an excuse for fat people to keep eating. This is something that someone tweeted to Sunny Seagold once. Binge eating disorder is simply a lack of willpower. Just stop. So she says the last two assume that compulsive chronic binge eating is a choice. No one would choose this. No one would choose the shame, discomfort, depression, self-loathing, and digestive damage that comes with binge eating disorder. People with anxiety, depression, and a history of weight bullying or extreme dieting are also more likely to develop binge eating disorder than anyone else. So yes, it is a real condition, people. Myth number three, diets or obesity surgery can cure binge eating disorder. Now, this is something, by the way, my friend and Kelly Gunter, the author Kelly Gunter, can really speak to because she had surgery and she lost 243 pounds and wrote a book, You Have Such a Pretty Face, about how losing all that weight did not make her happy. And instead of binge eating, because she couldn't do that anymore, she turned to other things like gambling and things like that. So really, binge eating was an answer, a solution to the problem. It wasn't the problem. So diets or obesity surgery cannot cure binge eating disorder. It can make you have, you know, lose weight, make it harder for you to eat large amounts of food, but underlying behavioral issues, underlying emotional conflicts persist if they're not addressed. Research has shown that up to 30% of people who have bariatric and other kinds of lap band surgeries develop what's called addiction transference post-surgery. And they start abusing alcohol or other substances instead of binge eating. And that's what I was talking about with Kelly. You know, her addiction transference was when she went from being addicted to food, actually addicted to eating, because you're not addicted to the substance of food. You're addicted, if we're going to use that word, to eating as a way of feeling better. Big difference. Tiny semantic change, food addiction versus eating addiction, but really, really important. Many binge eaters are chronic dieters. She tried a ton of diets, but nothing ever worked because the urge to binge would always come back even stronger than before. That's because the cause of binge eating is not liking food too much. It's not about not knowing about nutrition. It's not about not having enough willpower. It's a complex condition, and it is a psychological, primarily psychological condition. So the treatment is psychotherapy, not diets or surgery. And by the way, people with binge eating disorder are black, white, brown, straight, gay, skinny, fat, young, old, and everything in between. They're beauty queens and pop stars. They're construction workers and football players. They're your kid's teacher, your boss, that hot girl from reality TV. Letting go of stereotypes about who binge eats and why can open up the doors for more people to get the help they deserve, she says. And amen to that. So if you think you may have binge eating disorder, do yourself a favor, get some help. Go on the National Eating Disorders Association website, check out edreferral.com, Eating Disorders Hope, and get some help. There are free groups out there also if you can't afford therapy. Free groups maybe in your community. There are free groups online. There is help and there is hope. Okay, here is a question from Amanda in Florida. She writes, Dr. Nina, I doubt I'll be able to call into your show this week. If you have a chance, I'd like to hear your thoughts on the connection between food and grief. My aunt is dying in the ICU, and I sadly anticipate traveling soon to her funeral. I've been wanting to comfort myself with food as I process losing her. I know when someone dies, it seems that people bring food to the family's home, And there's so much food, at least in my experience, after the funerals and the memorial services at receptions. What is a good way to process grief and not turn to food for comfort? Also, what's a good way to politely say no to relatives with good intentions who want to feed us during those times when emotions are heightened? So those are great questions, Amanda. Let's start with the first question. What is a good way to process grief and not turn to food for comfort? Okay, so there's this German word. I'm probably going to butcher it, but let me try. It's Kummerspeck. Kummerspeck. It literally translated means grief bacon. So what does Kummerspeck mean? It refers to the weight that people gain when they overeat out of grief and sorrow. Sometimes called grief eating. It's essentially a form of comfort eating. So why does grief lead to comfort eating? Because food is soothing. Food can comfort you. It can numb you. It can distract you from your deeper pain. And grief is a particularly intense time. If you're going through mourning, you may be especially more prone to comfort eating. So while I'm answering Amanda's question about grief eating, really this applies to all forms of comfort eating. Anytime you eat something to make yourself feel better, whether the source is grief or something else, this is going to apply to you. So after a significant loss, or when something is bothering you, people use some kind of diversion. Sleeping too much, drinking, sleeping, shopping, working too much, or eating to dull the pain and, in the case of grief, fill up the empty space that you feel because of the loss. Now, if you've just lost someone, it's understandable, or you're going to lose someone in Amanda's case, it's understandable that you would turn to food to cope with your pain. It is not a sign of weakness. It's not a sign of a lack of willpower or being undisciplined. Your mind is just trying to find a way to make you feel better. So first of all, Amanda, have some compassion for why you are using food during this time. And it's important to be aware of your emotional triggers. So grief is a huge factor in what triggers comfort eating. But there might be also more specific things like seeing your family at the funeral. That could be a trigger for some people. Managing the estate afterwards. I'm not sure that would be the case for you, Amanda. But, you know, arguments with family members and painful memories. And also, for some people, when someone dies, it's the end of hope that you could have a better relationship with them. So just knowing, you know, how you're being triggered or what situations or thoughts are triggering can help you address those specifically so you don't use food as a distraction to cope. Also, so Amanda, knowing the stages of grief can help you prepare for and process them. Everyone grieves differently, but if you understand the stages of grief and your emotions and you take care of yourself and you seek support, you can heal. So what are the stages of grief? Now, this applies to the loss of a person. It also applies to the end of relationships or the loss of hope in other cases. So this comes from Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, which was specifically about death and dying, but it can be about all kinds of other things. Like some people might have to mourn the loss of a career they can't have. Someone who's a singer who can't sing anymore because she had throat surgery. I'm totally making this up. Now has to mourn the loss of a certain part of her life or his life. So grief can be about a lot of different things. So the first stage is denial. And by the way, I'm talking about them in stages, but people don't move through them like a checklist, like, okay, got denial done. Like it's denial, anger, bargaining, depression, acceptance. But it's not like you're like, okay, done with denial, check. Now onto anger, feel your anger. Done with anger, check. Unfortunately, it doesn't work that way. You know, you can start with depression and go to denial and go back to anger. And you know, you can, these are just all kinds of feelings that you have in the process. So denial, when you first learn of a loss of some kind, it is normal to think, nope, no. That's why often when people get bad news, they're like, no. They go into, it's not happening. They feel shocked. They feel numb. And this is a temporary way to deal with the overwhelming emotion of loss. It's a defense mechanism. Like, no, I deny that this is happening. It can't be. There must be some mistake. Someone else, it's someone else that died, not this person. Or, you know, something else bad that happened to someone else, not whatever. Then anger. As reality sets in, you are faced with the pain of your loss, and you may feel frustrated and helpless. You might feel angry at the world, angry at God, angry that you have to live life without this person, angry for not being able to have the life and the person that you want in your life. You could be angry with a loved one who died and left you alone. This is really common and natural. And, you know, I had a friend a long time ago, Phil, who I'm still angry at him. I'm still mad at him because he had a terrible drinking problem and wouldn't get help, and eventually died of complications of alcoholism, which I saw as slow suicide. I'm still mad at him. And for years, I would feel so guilty. How could I be mad at him? He's gone. I should be sad, right? But it turns out that really anger is a very common feeling when you lose someone. Bargaining. Bargaining is, oh, if only I would have done this, then maybe this wouldn't have happened. For example, my friend Phil had called me. He called me like on a Monday, and I think he died on a Wednesday. And I had just a crazy week, and I was like, oh, I'm going to call him. I can't call him today. I can't call him tomorrow. I'll call him Wednesday. And I thought later, oh, if only I had called him back, maybe he would still be alive. That's bargaining. If only I'd done this, maybe this wouldn't have happened. Or if only I do this, maybe the bad thing won't happen. The next step is depression, which is when you get really sad because you begin to understand the loss and the effect of that loss on your life. And when you're depressed, you know you're depressed, but in case you don't, here are some signs. Just crying, sleep issues, either you can't sleep or you sleep too much. Eating issues, either you can't eat or you eat too much. Comfort eating. You can feel overwhelmed, lonely, awful. You can feel like, what's the point of living? That's depression. And finally, you come to acceptance. You accept the reality of the loss. It can't be changed. The loss is there, but you can change the way you feel about it. Again, as I said, every person goes through these phases in her or his own way. You can go back and forth between them. You can skip one or more stages altogether. And then reminders of the loss, like the anniversary of the loss a year later, or a familiar song you used to listen to with the person, can trigger the return of grief. Also, something I hear a lot about grief is this. I shouldn't still be feeling this way. It's been a year. It's been 2 years. It's been 5 years. I shouldn't still be feeling this way. Well, there's no normal amount of time to grieve. But with time, any amount of time, which depends on the nature of the relationship you had with the person you lost, whether it's through death or another way, it eventually that sadness and anger and everything else does ease. And you'll be able to feel happiness and joy along with grief. So that's the first part of the question, Amanda. Here's the second part. What's a good way to politely say no to relatives with good intentions who want to feed us during those times when emotions are heightened? So this question also applies to, like, what do you do when you go to family get-togethers and there's the food pushers? There are those relatives who are like, oh, have some of this, or I bake this special, or just one bite won't hurt you, or, you know, come on, have a piece of pie already, right? Food pushers. So whether it's at a funeral or somewhere else, This is how you deal with food pushers. So Benjamin Franklin once said, by failing to prepare, you are preparing to fail. So the opposite is true. By being prepared, you will succeed. Okay, so imagine the relative who says, well, I knew I'd see you, so I made my special triple cream chocolate hazelnut cream cheese cake. What do you say to that? How do you deal with that? Two simple words. Oh, no thanks. The key is how you say it. Now, you can say just about anything if you say it the right way with the right tone. Remember that food is an expression of love. So when someone uses food to connect with you, to maybe, you know, strengthen the bond with you or show their love for you, try responding to their expression of love rather than eating the cake. The cake is a symbol of their love, maybe. Respond to the love, not the cake. As in, say, oh, it means so much that you were thinking of me. Thank you so much. I don't really feel like cake right now, but thank you so much. It means so much that you were thinking of me and you made me that cake. I really appreciate it. And then deflect, 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 deflect. As in, so what's your memory, if this is a funeral, so what, what's your favorite memory of, in Amanda's case, the aunt that she is losing? Change the subject. Deflection means change the subject. If they say, oh, one bite won't hurt you, have a taste. You say, oh, you know, it looks delicious and I'm sure it is super yummy, but I'm just not in the mood right now. And then deflect again. Yes. So remember that people want us to feel better, and that usually means food at these occasions. And we don't want to appear ungrateful, so we feel like we have no choice but to accept, because to not have that special triple cream chocolate hazelnut cheesecake is to possibly offend them. And we don't want to offend them, especially at a funeral or at a holiday. So don't worry so much about offending people. Say, no, it's so sweet of you to think of me. You're so thoughtful. I really appreciate you. I really appreciate that. Nobody is going to get offended at that. Nobody's going to get mad at you for that. But if they insist, and we are talking serious food pushery here, if they insist, one bite won't hurt you, go on, have some. Wow, shades of Mrs. Danvers telling Rebecca to jump off the tower at Mandalay. For those of you who know the book Rebecca or the movie, it's like you're hypnotized and you can't say no. They're like, go on, have some. Until you do, just say no. Like that old anti-drug commercial from the 80s. You guys remember that? Am I dating myself? Just remember that. Just say no. Just say no thanks. And then, oh my gosh, I see someone I need to talk to. Deflect. Move away. Get yourself away from the food pusher. Or you say, oh my gosh, I need to go to the restroom. I need to go to the ladies' room and leave. Or the men's room, as it may be. Or you say, gosh, you know what? My contacts are really bothering me. And you leave. Just leave. Just take care of yourself. And by the way, if you do have a piece of cake or whatever, remember, it is just a piece of cake. It is not a crime to eat cake. It doesn't make you a bad person any more than it makes you a good person to not eat the cake. So don't beat yourself up. Remember, a piece of cake is just that. It's just a piece of cake. It doesn't, not going to ruin your life, and it doesn't have to lead to three pieces of cake or the whole cake. It's just one piece. So hopefully that helps. If you have any questions for me, please give me a call, 818-602-4929. Oh, we have about 10 more minutes. So I would love to hear from you. 818-602-4929. What's going on? Tell me what is eating at you and let's talk about it. Okay, so I have been talking in the past. I have yet to be able to finish talking about how to improve your body image. So let me see if I can do some of that right now. So body image, which is, how we perceive our bodies, is especially for women, although for men too, I shouldn't really say that. I take it back. For all of us, we can be preoccupied with body image and we can focus on what is wrong with us. In other words, we can body shame ourselves. So we don't want to do that. Now, culturally, some of us have a perverse notion that poor body image is a sign of modesty. This is very true in England. My friend in England will say that she will look in the mirror with her girlfriends and be like, oh, look at this piece of, you know, plumpness right here, and look at this, I'm so fat, like almost like, oh no, I'm worse, oh no, I'm worse. And I said, well, that doesn't happen in America. So that perverse notion that poor body image is a sign of modesty is only going to you're only going to relate to this if you're living in England or Europe or something, because that is not the case here. But feeling bad about the way we look can be a devastating blow to our self-confidence, and it affects multiple aspects of our lives. Because if you don't feel good about how you look, you're not going to want to be intimate with your partner. You're not going to want to go date someone. You're not going to want to have a partner, meet a partner. You're not going to want to be seen in public. You're not going to want to go out with friends and eat in front of them. It goes on and on and on. You're not going to want to get a job because you're going to have to go in an interview, and you're not going to feel good about how you look in your suit. So you don't go for that job and you sit at home and you just end up having a job and a life that you don't really want, all because of the way you look. So we don't want that to continue. So here are 10 tips to get over bad body image. First of all, avoid offending media. What we read and watch has a huge impact on how we feel about ourselves. So be very particular about the websites and apps and magazines that you look at. Avoid TV programs that are very super, super image focused. Try to avoid ads. Ads are the worst. And only follow people on social media who make you feel good about yourself. If you go on social media and that person makes you feel bad about yourself, you start looking at their account and you're like, oh, compared to that person, I feel really bad. And you start feeling bad and bad and you, oh, block that account. Stop following them. You should only follow people who make you feel good. Which is, you know, consciously seek out media that reinforces positive self-image. Also, try looking at other kinds of things, like not just image-related accounts. Look at travel, wellness, you know, other kinds of media and magazines, politics. Read about interesting things. Expand your mind instead of worrying about making your body smaller. Also, stay away from shopping centers and department stores. Those places are insecurity dens. Everything from the lighting to the mannequins, everything is designed to make you feel inadequate. So why? Why do shopping centers do this? Why do department stores do this? Because when we feel inferior, we are much more open to being manipulated by the suggestions of department store displays, right? So we look at that mannequin and we're like, oh, well, maybe if I wore that, I could look like that. Unconsciously, I mean, obviously you know what you know, but these places are tapping into your unconscious. Avoid conversations about appearance. Avoid conversations about appearance. Again, whenever someone starts to talk about the way they look in a negative way, I stop them. In fact, I have a group, and one of the things that we have two rules: you can't use the F word, fat, and you can't talk about your body or anyone else's body. You can't say disparaging things about your body. You can't say anything bad about yourself, and you can't say anything good about someone else, because there's way too much emphasis on what we look like. How about what we feel like? How about what we're thinking about? How about what we're interested in? So getting caught up in conversations about what you look like compared to someone else, what someone else looks like, it just keeps your mind on something very small when there are so many more things, so many more interesting things to think about, so many things to learn or to be intrigued by other than comparison and feeling bad about yourself. Here's one that is important. It's to give yourself some gentle touch. Now, lots of times people don't want to go and get a massage or whatever because they're thinking, oh, the masseuse is thinking bad things about their bodies. That is not the case. But so often, when we don't get physical touch and we have sort of touch hunger, that hunger can be assuaged with food, right? We need to be touched, we need to be hugged, we need to have some kind of physical contact. If we don't get it, we do something else, we fill ourselves with food. In fact, one of my patients once told me that when she gets really full, she said it felt like she was, like her body was giving herself a hug. Like when the food like pushed out against her stomach, it felt like her body was hugging her. I don't know if that makes sense to you, but it made sense to me. So if you don't get gentle touch, whether it's a hug from a friend or a back rub from someone at the nail salon, I get my nails done, honestly, full disclosure, I go for the neck massage. The manicure is secondary. There are lots of ways that you can get like a massage or a hug or, you know, something. And it's so important because it's we have like touch hunger. And if we don't have that, then we respond to our bodies in a different way. We'll eat for comfort or we'll eat for other reasons. And when you get a gentle touch, it also reminds us to be gentle with ourselves. Also, replace negative thoughts with positive thoughts. How am I doing? Time. Only got a few more minutes. Okay, look. When you look in the mirror, what do you see? All right, do you look in the mirror and say, oh my God, I wish that this were this and this were smaller and this were bigger and I wish I had bigger hair and a smaller waist? And do you just look in the mirror and find fault? Well, if you do, remember that we find the evidence that we look for. So if you're looking for evidence of how you're not good enough, back to Nicole's idea, if you're not physically good enough, if your appearance is not good enough, try looking for different evidence because we all have something that we like about ourselves. If you really like your hair or you really like your eyes or you really like your smile or you really like something, you really like the strength of your arms or, you know, find something that you like about your body image and reinforce that. Because when we just look for the flaws, we see the flaws and then we feel bad about ourselves and that's all we think about. And then we feel bad about ourselves, we don't feel good about ourselves, vulnerable to using food to cope or using food for comfort. So try looking in the mirror and really noticing what it is you like. Ask a friend. If you have a best friend, ask a friend, hey, what do you like about how I look? And you might be surprised. If you can't figure it out on your own, ask a friend or a loved one or your partner or something. And when they tell you, believe them. Don't do that thing where they say, oh, you have the most beautiful smile and the most enchanting eyes. And then you say to yourself, oh, well, they're just saying that because they're trying to be nice. No, don't say that. Don't do that to yourself. Don't make them wrong. Make them right. Think to yourself, wow, I love how they see me. I do have enchanting eyes. I do have a nice smile. And the more that you think this way, the more you program yourself to look in the mirror and like what you see. That is so important. It may seem impossible, but as Nelson Mandela said, and he should know, it is only impossible until it is done. Practice makes progress. Look in the mirror. Don't let yourself have any of those nasty negative body image thoughts. Focus on what you do like. Focus on what you do like, and you're going to feel better. Find a purpose. This is another way to have a better sense of self-esteem and body image. Find a purpose, because people who have a purpose are too busy getting stuff done to worry about how they look or worry so much about how they look. In the end, creative expression, passionate parenting, effective leadership, and growing the best tomatoes in the neighborhood, whatever it is that your purpose is, that is far more satisfying than making sure you look good in an outfit that's in your closet. Right? Find a purpose. Figure out, what do you love? What do you care about? What are you passionate about? Light a fire within you and find something that you feel good about. I promise you, that is going to occupy way more space in your mind than what you weigh and what you look like. And that is our show for today. So thank you so much for joining me. I am here every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Pacific here on LA Talk Radio. If you ever miss the show, you can get it on the Dr. Nina Show on LA Talk Radio, wherever you get podcasts, Apple Podcasts, all podcasts. And also check out, if you're on Instagram or if you go on my website, drninainc.com, check out my new webinar, which is called How to Live a Happier, Healthier Life Without Binge Eating. I think you're going to love it. I'd love for you to watch it. And take good care of yourself. Be curious, not critical. And I will see you next week. Bye for now.
You're listening to The Dr. Nina Show with Dr. Nina Savelle-Rocklin, only on LA Talk Radio.